Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome back to Critical Mash. Today we return to the extraordinary and turbulent arts world of the early 20th century that we visited last time, that was bursting with new ideas that would drag art and music and everything else into the modern age and make previously undreamed of connections between them. So this time we're starting from the upcoming Tate Modern exhibition, Expressionists, Vasily Kandinsky, Gabriela Munter and the Blue Rider. And we are delighted to be joined by the exhibition's lead curator, Natalia Sidlina, who is international curator at Tate Modern, by Gerard McBurney, composer, writer, broadcaster, teacher, and polymath, who knows everything and particularly everything about everything Russian, which is going to be interesting, and by my critical colleagues from last time and friends, the Lucy Lethbridge, the author of her most recent book is Tourists, How the British Went Abroad to Find Themselves, and others besides. Servants was another your previous one, Lucy?
It was.
And my fellow music critic and opera buff, Yehuda Shapiro, who needs no further introduction. So don't go anywhere, and we're about to find out what expressionism really means, Natalia. How abstraction was born, and how one little artistic group in Munich developed ideas about the meaning and purpose of art that would inevitably lead to a spiritual renewal of the world through the mystical interaction of all art forms and all human senses, a massive son et lumière show in the Himalayas, and a whole lot of Aleister Crowley-style sex magic. And I think I've understood that right. And that's it all starts with the Blue Rider in Munich in about 1989, something like that, yeah. I'm your host, Robert Thickness. This is Critical Mash, the arts podcast of The Critic magazine, which is the antidote to ghettoized art forms, puffery, PR, and dumbing down. So, Natalia, I'm going to put you on the spot to begin with. First of all, I would like you to ask you a bit about the exhibition and to position the Blue Rider for us among the many groups recombining and dissolving around all those European centres and even non-centres like Munich, which is a bit of a surprise. You expect them to be in Paris and Vienna, and you know, but here they are in Munich. Tell us more about them, please.
Thank you, Robert. I'm just going to counter your Kandinsky quote with one from Franz Marc, Kandinsky's close friend. The renewal must not be merely formal, but a rebirth of thinking. And of course, one of another key founding member of the Blue Rider Collective, of Gabriela Munter, who gave a wonderfully beautiful description of what the Blue Rider actually was, saying that we were only a group of friends who shared a common passion for painting as a form of self-expression, each of us interested in the work of the other, in the health of the other, and the happiness of the others. And it's exactly that communal spirit which we want to highlight in our Tate Modern's Expressionist Kandinsky Munter and the Blue Rider exhibition, which will open in April this year. It was the first modernist collective that proclaimed that the whole work called art knows no boundaries or nations, only humanity. And we will consider Blue Rider Circle of Artists as they grappled with the same concerns that still are the concerns of the current generation of the 21st century creatives. It's multiple identities, fluid sexuality, migratory experiences, ethnic intolerance, everyday chauvinism, war and its trauma. And we look at them as they expressed all those feelings and experiences through boundless experimentation, radicalism, and polymath practices.
So I suppose that most of your pictures come from the
Lemberhaus.
Right, thank you, in Munich, which was Gabriela Munter gave, when she was 80, she gave something like 1,000 pictures to that gallery, and that's where they are. And is that where most of the pictures come from? Is that the source of most of the exhibition?
Absolutely. So talking about women involved in the Blue Rider, you've mentioned Natalia Goncharova and Gabriela Munter, only two women whose works were illustrated in the Blue Rider almanac. Actually, the almanac came last. Before the almanac, we had both Blue Rider exhibition. We had Kandinsky's publication on Concerning the Spiritual in Art. Almanac was meant to be first in the long line of annual exhibition, thus almanac, to celebrate the interest in creation of Gesamtkunstwerk amongst the visual artists of the early 20th century. So this is incredible ambition to symbiosis of all forms of art, probably for the first time since the Middle Ages, for the music, for the visual art, for performance, to dance, theatricality, architecture, interior design, to exist together. This interest driven artists not only to abstraction. For a very long time, we continue looking at the hierarchical development of the early modernists towards abstraction. If we read Almanac very closely, we'll see that what the artists were aiming for was total abstraction and total realism. And both Kandinsky and Munter and other members of the Blue Rider group considered both tendencies very important and key for the development of the renewal, spiritual renewal in the arts.
But you're talking about a kind of spiritual realism rather than a, because I think it was Malevich said, you know, just drawing what you see is like totally over. And now we're doing the inner spiritual reality of the artist. I mean, so it's that kind of spiritual realism that they're after. We're going to get onto that whole kind of symbiosis of the arts because it's such an amazing thing. But first of all, I wanted to say that the title of the exhibition is Expressionism. And I mean, we were kind of mulling it around among ourselves and thinking, well, can anyone define expressionism actually? Because you know, like, what is it? And it's like, is it like neurosis, extreme emotional states, bright lights, bright colours, all a bit Germanic? Or is it kind of Matisse? And you know, and what is it? Can you tell us what expressionism is, please?
You're absolutely right. It wasn't easy to come up with a title for the exhibition. So a big group of colleagues sat together and we started thinking, how do we express in one or two words exactly what you were talking about? The bright colours, dynamic forms, angst of the early silent cinema, atonal music, free poetry, early dance, and the only word which came to mind was expressionism. And you're absolutely right, there is no one description all the academics would agree with. And it's not something we were aiming for. We're not aiming for an academic exhibition tracing the roots and hierarchy and history of expressionism. We were looking into presenting a community of artists who work together, not because they graduated from the same school, not because they were mates having parties together, and not because they came from the same background or the same city. It was the brotherhood and sisterhood, the communion of spirit between people who came from a Pale of Settlement in the former Russian Empire, from the conservative backgrounds in the US, from other empires dominating European scene at the time, Austro-Hungary like Schoenberg and Bossi, or German empire like August Mercky and Franz Marc, who was the only Munich-based born and bred artist within the collective.
And in fact, I mean, they're kind of wildly different artists, and you have the completely unclassifiable Paul Klee, who's, you know, who can't really label him in any way. And Franz Marc, similarly, I mean, is he a kind of lovely painter of blue horses or an expressionist or a colourist or, you know, what? We're going to do that in a minute. I now would like to ask Gerard a thing about this very important moment in this collaboration, which was the 1st of January 1911, when Kandinsky and Franz Marc...
2nd of January.
It doesn't look nearly so good. 1st of January really works. Okay, but
they had a part. They had a New Year party.
Yeah, it was a good one.
On the 1st, they were too tired. On the 2nd, they went
okay,
to the concert.
Okay, I'm too tired to go to concert. Yes, no, we've all been there. On the 2nd of January 1911, when they went to this concert where they were, and they'd kind of met each other recently, I think, Marc and Kandinsky at this
the
point.
Day before at the party. Oh,
at the party. They'd become like,
party.
Are you my best mate?
Exactly.
And all that. And then they went to this concert where Schoenberg's 2nd string quartet and 3 piano pieces, can't remember what opus number, were played.
11.
Right. I assumed you would know that. And then this kind of idea, the idea was then born in Kandinsky that he was very envious of the ability of music not to have to depict things, its abstraction. And this kind of led him down his path. Well, tell us about that.
Well, I don't know very much about that, really, to be honest. I know something about how Schoenberg was drawn towards Kandinsky, not least because Schoenberg was flattered by Kandinsky's interest in him. But part of that was because Schoenberg was an amateur painter. I think it's not unfair to call him an amateur painter. I speak as somebody who has looked through about 200 of his paintings in the Vienna Stiftung. They're fascinating because they're the fascinating product of a great imagination, but they're not terribly exciting as paintings, let's just say that.
Kandinsky's music's probably rubbish as well, but he did write some.
He did write some. I think more interesting to me than that is how in the wake of their encounter with each other and their correspondence is quite humorous, unintentionally humorous. You could make rather a good two-hand play out of the way these two men talk to one another, each trying to be the great artist. They both had, of course, we remember this from Schoenberg very much, but also from Kandinsky and the stuff he talks in on the spiritual in art. These were boys with boys' intellectual pretensions, saloon bar pontification about philosophy and eternal verities.
Well, it makes sense from football. I mean, it's kind of good, kind of talking about the spiritual, you know, and the spiritual ecstasy rather than and pan-aestheticism rather than, you know.
But it leads quite quickly to where I find their paths most interestingly touching on one another, which is when, largely under the impact of his meeting of Kandinsky, but not entirely because there are other people involved, Schoenberg writes his 2nd one-act opera, monodrama, call it what you will, the Glückliche Hand, which the late, great Hans Keller memorably translated as the knack, because it's a German idiom that doesn't translate very well into English. The lucky hand, it used to be translated, but that doesn't mean much.
The fateful hand, I've seen the translation.
Yes, fateful. Glückliche is it?
Happy.
Happy or
lucky?
Happy-go-lucky. It's something to do with, it's a phrase that I would have thought touches most interestingly on the arbitrariness of card playing,
yeah.
Which is, oh my gosh, I've had a good
hand. A good hand, right.
a good hand, that's right, yes. Anyway, in Schoenberg's pieces where he was self-consciously experimenting with the connection between music and colour are not that many, and they all come pretty much from that period. But Glückliche Hand is the locus of that, because the libretto contains quantities of descriptions of changing colours and lights, at least as detailed, if not more detailed, than the similar instructions in Scriabin's work. And Schoenberg was trying to map his response to these imaginary colours through what he was composing. But Schoenberg, oddly enough, given that he's most famous to the man in the street, or more likely the woman in the street, as the perpetrator of the 12-note method of composing, which is not a method, he's thought of as a schematic composer, but actually he's one of the least schematic composers that has ever lived. The music that he wrote, which is not a vast amount, he always wrote at incredible speed, like a man possessed. And so therefore he didn't come, as Scriabin did, or Rimsky-Korsakov did, earlier people who were already experimenting with colour and music. They had methods, they worked out. Scriabin famously drew himself a rather elaborate diagram saying exactly what... It's not exactly a chord, it's not exactly a tonality, but I would call them clusters of notes that he considered to represent yellow or yellow to orange or all the rest of it. Rimsky-Korsakov thought entirely in terms of keys and modes, and those were the ones, and his conclusion about what was silver and what was yellow were completely different.
Completely different. I mean, there was a story about them sitting around with Rachmaninoff in the pub in Paris, and Rachmaninoff saying, you know, it's all rubbish. You say that yellow is G major and you say that yellow is this. And it's nonsense, isn't it? And, you know, admit it. And they were saying, no. And you also believe it subconsciously because you wrote that thing in the lively night that is actually, you wrote about gold and it's in the gold key.
Which is what...
And so that proves that subconsciously you understood this thing. And Rachmaninoff goes, no, I copied that from you. I put it in B major because I've nicked it from your thing. And then they, Scriabin and Rimsky, stormed out, leaving him to pay the bill.
And he said in the interview, which was then concocted by journalists into those memoirs, he said both gentlemen seemed very pleased with themselves.
They thought they'd won the argument, but they hadn't. What they'd won is because they didn't pay. I mean, they just left him. He was sat there with them. No, they've been drinking all afternoon.
But the point is, I suppose... the point is that there was a lot of speculation about colour and music around at that time, partly because some work had been quasi-scientific or primitive psychological, neurological work had been published by doctors on the phenomenon of synesthesia, though, as I understand it, I spoke to a neurologist once who was a specialist in synesthesia, and he said to me, for he was a he said... that the coming together of colour and music was the rarest form of all, very unusual, and for his part, he didn't believe that any of these composers were being honest when they were.
But it's a sort of spiritual reality, right? It's not sort of something we're talking about. They wanted it to be true. They had intuited that such a thing existed, and they were striving to express it in some way.
I think that's
what it's all about.
That's absolutely true. And one of the reasons why it's very interesting that Schoenberg should reach out to Kandinsky at that particular point about his painting, rather. Kandinsky was approaching him about his music, but he wanted reassurance that his paintings were interesting. Well, one of the reasons is that he was painting without any technique, sort of Sunday painter stuff. He would do it, and then he would gaze at his own painting in an effort to search for a chord or a gesture, because this was the only way he could kick his imagination into working. He became very, very interested. I don't think he was ever that sure about synesthesia, but he was sure, and that comes over loud and clear through his whole life, that in order for a human being to create something new, you had to step back and put in another impetus. So you would start with words, you would start with a colour, you would start with a memory, or quite sort of banally and obvious, as in his Pelléas und Mélisande, you would start with a story that many people would know, and you would try and clothe that story, use that story as a kind of clothesline that you pin your music on. And he was definitely interested at that point in using the colours which he himself was creating and the shapes that he was creating as a way of generating musical ideas. However, with Glückliche Hand, he was dealing with a script by somebody else who had written the stage directions, very elaborate stage directions, I think with the agreement of Schoenberg, this was the idea. And so by whatever means, he was looking at the author's script and going, and now the stage turns orange. And then he would freeze himself into a sort of, like a deer in the headlights and go, orange, ah, I have it. And the chord would appear. But it was all, in the end, it was, I think with him, all about releasing the unconscious, which is a word that you used before. It was very, very instinctive. It was, I would also say, which is true of some of these people, I certainly feel this very strongly about Kandinsky, who is a pretend intellectual if ever there was one, that it's childlike, it's sophomoric, it's like undergrad. It's like the opening of The Longest Journey when all those people are sitting around.
I had a feeling you were going to take a dim view of the spiritual aspects of this picture. I don't know where I got that feeling from, but I did.
So interesting what Jared just said about Lucky Hand. Actually, Schoenberg worked on it in Murnau in conversation with Kandinsky, who was working at the same time on The Yellow Sound with Thomas von Hartmann and Sakharov.
The dancer, the performer, the dancer,
absolutely. So, and they were all in this big boy band trying to establish, trying to be pioneers in all things. So Kandinsky just in 1907 had a bad experience in Paris. He went there. No one was impressed by what he was doing. He was based in the most bourgeois suburb in Sèvres, near Paris, not mixing much with the Parisian hoi polloi. He went back, discovered Murnau, I started building around him a network of a much younger friends and colleagues who sustained his ambition for a pioneering effort in art. He started working with other artists, trying to be first. He went for the first time back to Russia in 1910, after a very large break, and he discovered that the ideas he had were very much bubbling up in Moscow as well. New reformed theatre, music and performance, folk art, and total artwork. So he comes back with all those impressions, with all those new ideas, and he starts thinking, how do I make myself first? And his approach was, let's just theorize the hell out of it. And this is why in 1911 he completed the manuscript of his On the Spiritual and Art, putting the theoretical foundations, or rather summarizing what he was already doing and thinking and giving you directions and vectors for the things to come, to set it in stone. It's, publish or perish. So his response was, I might not be the first person who comes up with something, but at least I'm the first who puts it all on paper. And this is why it was important for him that On the Spiritual and Art came before the Almanac. Also to create a mythology around it, saying that he actually worked on this manuscript for years and years and years, and only now had a moment to put it all together and publish it. So his theorizing and his approach to color was very much developed alongside his very, very ambition to be a pioneer in the field. He was also building his mythology. Just like Gerald said, they all had different approaches to color. They all claim different symbolism for color. Kandinsky's approach was in a way, developed at the same time as Marx started experimenting with color and with science and with prisms. And also Robert Delaunay, who was experimenting in Paris with simultanism. And actually those figures like Claire, Marc and Delaunay were very much cooking in their own juices in different parts of the world without networks, without academic education, and through the connection with the Blau writer, they found the purchase and they found approval for moving forward and for their theories, and they found the community which allowed them to express themselves. They found people of the similar spirit and the similar ambitions.
Something that really interested me was the fact you said it was a sort of a collective with lots of different disciplines within it. Was that a fairly radical move at the time to sort of, was there a sort of a manifesto for it? And was it also, the other thing that interests me is was there a post-industrial aspect to it? Because it's a bit like Art Nouveau, for instance, was basically a sort of industrial, it was driven by industry. And was that reflected at all in the sort of the mentality of the Blauhiter, or was it an escape from industrialism or whatever?
As far as the community is concerned, this is what separated them from any other modernist group. They were totally different in the way that they stepped away from manifestos and they stepped away from any boundaries associated with a group or an association. There was no membership. There's no such thing as a Blauhiter group. There were no parameters with regards to what style is in line with the group style. There was no limit for specific media. There were artists, there were performers, there were musicians. There were more musicians, more talk about sound in the almanac than about painting. Women artists took part. Sakharov was able to reinforce his androgynous persona through the performances supported by Verovkin, and was drawn into the work on the almanac through the work on the yellow sound with Kandinsky. So this is why we, for the first time within the exhibition, we call them community, because they were not a group. They were all about opening up. They were all about trying different things. They were all about radicalism and revolting against things. So there's no statement. Even Almanac can't be considered their manifesto. A program, maybe, but not really a manifesto.
So, purely aesthetic, in fact. I mean, is it anti-materialist, is it?
I think they had such a wonderful time with each other. You know, been friends, intimate collaborators, lovers, best friends, people who could work creatively, who could help each other. It was very handy to creating networks. All this talk about Kandinsky, thinking about spirituality or color or music. In fact, when you look at his writing, there's enormous amount of correspondence where he creates networks, where he builds relationship with museum curators, with collectors, with publishers, with galleries trying to promote his work, sell his work, exhibit his work, publish his work. Most of what he was writing at the time was self-promotion correspondence, and we bring it into the exhibition as well.
Do you think it all worked for him? Is that why one of the reasons he's one of the top painters of the 20th century?
Absolutely, yeah. The history shows it's totally worked. So Blauhiter, including Kandinsky, set out the parameters of what it means to be a successful modern artist. You don't just work in your studio creating works and exhibiting them. You have to network, you have to self-promote, you have to be a curator, you have to be art critic, you have to be your own art dealer. And something we associate with very successful artists of today, you could find the roots and you can find the links with the strategies developed by the Blau writer artist in the early years of the 20th century. It wasn't one or the other. You can't be an idealist and a successful artist at the same time. You build your own destiny. And they realized it very early on. And Kandinsky was in his 40s. He was one of the oldest members of the Blau writer collective. Probably Yevlensky and Verovkin were a bit older than him. But he looked at the artists who were 10, 15, 20 years younger than him, who were at the beginning of their careers. And he was thinking, wait a second, I really need to do something in order to make a mark. And that was really important for him. Making a mark, being a pioneer, creating something which will open new doors, creating something which will make him one of the key figures of his time, of his era.
How does that compare to Schoenberg in terms of the, I was thinking, you know, he's kind of one of the towering figures of 20th century music. Was he as conscious in his career development as Kandinsky obviously was?
So to some extent that's true. I also think in Schoenberg's case you have something else, which is a different subject and maybe not for today. But as you watch his life unfold, you have this growing sense of himself as the Jewish teacher. And that's a different subject. But somehow the two things collided at some point. And the great point where it collided in his life was when his students said, you have to write a book. And he said, I haven't got time to write a book. So they paid for him out of their own pockets to give a series of lectures on the nature of harmony, which, of course, is very, very close to what he'd been thinking about with the Murnau gang and all the rest of them. And he gave those lectures, and Webern and Beg and a bunch of others transcribed them as best they could. And they produced a book which is, I guess, certainly in music, probably the most important aesthetic manifesto of that time, although like Wagner, it's yards of it are very almost incomprehensible.
Quite quick, because I was very interested in this idea of Schoenberg seeing himself as the master, and I wondered if that's something to do with, you know, the long withdrawing roar and the increasing secularization, the way that artists begin to see themselves as a new priesthood, you know, artists across all disciplines.
Well, I'm sure that's the case, and we have not only the shadow of Wagner, but we have the particular shadow of the politics. And I'm not talking about the disagreeable politics of his pieces, which are many and fertile, but I'm thinking about Meistersinger and the whole idea of who Hans Sachs is and what he's saying, which...
Holy German art.
It had a long resonance and affected the language in which people talked. But then through Zimlinski, Schoenberg came to be close to Gustav Mahler, who was definitely somebody with a sense of themselves as the high priest of world culture. And with some justification, given the scale of his genius in various forms. But I feel that if you look day by day, as it were, on the interactions of Tweedledum and Tweedledee, as Alma Mahler contemptuously called them, meaning Schoenberg and Zemlinsky, when they came to visit her husband, who was the master, that these two boys were going, we want to do that too, we want to be a master. Mm. But you can even associate it with the passion that so many of those people had for Rosicrucianism, mm-hmm, and all of that nonsense.
Well, this actually comes back to this, exactly. The connection between, theosophy, Rosicrucianism, Madame Blavatsky, George Gurdjieff, the gang, right? They know he was very strong on them. But, and Lucy's point about them being the priests of this kind of hermetic, mystical, new spiritual enlightenment, this definitely totally applies to Kandinsky as well, that they have perceived and is going to be, you know, it's a kind of, you have to harness all the mystical relations between all the senses, and once you've done that, something incredibly sublime and transformative will happen. And the fellow who walked the walk on this as Kandinsky recognised, was Alexander Scriabin, the composer. And Kandinsky said that in his poem of Fire, he said he's nailed it there. He's really got it. And the whole synesthesia and thing and all the senses working together. But as you have said, Gerard, actually, the poem of Fire and the ecstasy that's produced through it seems somehow more sexual than aesthetic.
Well, I think I was talking about the poem of ecstasy rather than the poem of fire. I have to say, before God, but yeah, they are. But before God and as an honest man, I don't really understand Prometheus. I've struggled with it for many, many years, and I have a kind of, every time I go back to it, thinking I'm going to crack it, I have a sort of WTF reaction to it.
But it is rather marvellous, isn't it? And the way that I mean, everything happens and you wind up with this wordless chorus and everything, and it says climax. And
it is, but it's also, as I hesitate to bring up such an opposite figure, but as Shostakovich famously sniped, it's so fantastically badly written for the orchestra that it's we're back to amateurism here, like Schoenberg's painting, that he didn't really have the orchestral experience which would have led him to write a piece where we could actually hear the layers within it. It can about be done by somebody. There are conductors who manage to bring it off, but as with the music of a number of other composers of that period, the conductor has to sit down basically and correct all the harmonics, the dynamics, and strip out some of the orchestra.
And then you need to find somebody who can play the colour organ. To make the world go like blue and yellow.
That's of course the poem of ecstasy. The colour organ is in the poem of ecstasy. I don't know, Robert, if you've ever seen the colour organ. Have you seen the colour organ?
Not in action.
No. Well,
not in anger.
In his museum flat.
Museum apartment.
Yes.
On the
quartiere.
Yes, on the Arbat, where lovingly preserved are some of the bric-a-brac from. Scriabin's work, and there is the colour organ, which consists of a large circle, very badly cut out of chipboard, basically, with a series of 12 light bulbs around it, with wires dangling and from them, and they've been painted, and the paint, of course, has fallen off. So it really looks more like a Blue Peter object.
It was a bit rubbish. But in its kind of platonic conception, yeah. When they were going to do Mysterium, and this is what we're finally going to come to with when Mysterium, which was the great Scriabin's greatest thing that Kandinsky would very much have enjoyed, they were going to it was going to take place in the Himalayas. They were going to light up the entire Himalayas in the colours,
yes.
The requisite colours of the thing, and play this thing Mysterium, play and sing and everything else, and the world would dissolve in some form of spiritual ecstasy. In fact, all matter would dissolve, wouldn't it? And Scriabin was kind of a messiah character because he was born on Christmas Day.
He wanted...
And then there would be the sex magic as well.
Yeah, well,
We have raised the hope of sex magic.
Several times.
And we need this is when it happens.
He wanted to stop time. This is very exciting. It reminds one of Mystic Meg on the beach at Brighton or whatever. It's that level of spirituality. I don't want to trash these great artists too much, but there is
on Brighton they don't say they're going to stop time. That's Dennis Wheatley. That's The Devil Rides Out. You know, come on. This is serious stuff. Stopping time. Come on.
Yeah, stopping time. And one of the problems with it is that he's very specific about the cosmic choir in the Himalayas that are going to sing his work, which is this vast array of young men and young women who are dressed in absolutely nothing but sheets draped over them, as it were, on which the colours, of course, will be projected. And the idea is that the sort of huge erotic frisson that's going to take place between these men and women on the sides of a mountain in the Himalayas would be powerful enough to bring time to a halt. But the sexual aspect, which is easy to make fun of course, but
sounds good.
It sounds great. In the poem of ecstasy, he comes up with a much, much simpler idea, but it has to be said it's not a very politically correct idea. And Scriabin, the politics of Scriabin's view of sexuality do not, I hesitate to use this word, bear very much close examination. So that in the poem of Ecstasy, he uses a trumpet to represent, as he coyly says, the masculine spirit, but he's obviously representing something rather more specific than the masculine spirit. And he drives this trumpet higher and higher and higher. Meanwhile, the cosmic female spirit is represented by a lonely solo violin who's awfully, awfully sort of yielding. And I, who am the proud father of two grown-up daughters with very strong political feelings, I could imagine taking them to that piece and they would put up their hands and go, excuse me, Mr. Scriabin, there is some misrepresentation, gender misrepresentation going on there. But I actually, to me, the poem of Ecstasy, is a more, with its colour, so-called colour organ, its colour keyboard, as he called it, which is capable of being realised by modern technology in a large number of ways, and many people have interestingly tried to do that. To me, that is a more interesting piece because I find it more tolerable because it's more contained. However stupid it may or irritating it may seem to you, the idea of the basically male and female bodies as represented in this piece, at least that's a simple dramatic idea. And you don't need very much imagination as you hear the trumpet and the solo violin twining around one another to understand what it is that...
Well, it's a little bit like Richard Strauss or something, isn't it? I mean, he just does pretty much exactly the same thing, but with a horn.
Yes, a horn and a solo violin.
Yeah, and a solo violin.
Especially...
Female sexuality. I don't know, these guys seem to have a very... what kind of view do they have of it?
We're thinking about art made in the era of Freud, and we remember that Mahler went off to consult Freud, not very successfully, but I sort of feel that Uncle Richard and Uncle Alexander could have been sent off quite successfully to Amsterdam for a quick bunch of sessions on the... on the reclining chair in his room. But anyway... I think it's interesting. I think that to me it's more interesting what is happening in the piano music, the late piano music, because he was unquestionably a formidable pianist and he knew exactly what he was doing, and he was able to play in such a way that, to put it very crudely, this sounds like Auntie coming out of the concert afterwards, that he was able to conjure the most extraordinary colours. And I've never been quite sure to what extent he was aware of what he was doing. Rimsky was probably more aware of that, but he was playing very, very interesting games, as were a lot of composers of that period, Debussy being another obvious one, with overtones. And of course, for a musician, especially when you're playing a late 19th century piano, which is strung at enormous force, and that enables the strings to produce these clouds of overtones. And what these composers were interested in France, in Russia, in Schoenberg, of course, in Opus 19, they were interested in playing with the resonance on the piano, so that on a really well-tuned piano, a really great piano, in a concert hall with a really good acoustic, you would start to hear all kinds of, you can call them mysticals, buzzes that trick the ear, which are you can see why those people went, but this is colour. They needed a word to describe what it was that they were hearing and why they were reaching for one another's art. But of course, now we look at what those people are doing, as we look at the way the great painters were painting with using colour, and what we're dealing with really is laws of perception. And there weren't that many people, as I understand it, there weren't that many people around because they didn't have the
kind of scientific language to talk about.
Scientific language to talk about it. But now when you look at it, it's really interesting.
Gerard, you were talking about the stopping time, and I think you've actually kind of managed to stop time with this talk of of things. But it is unfortunately stopping time now. And I wanted to go on and take to talk about the work of Nikolai Obukhov and Goncharovo, who were going to create a temple of sound and take the whole Scriabin thing a step further. But we'll do that next time. Natalia, thank you so much for coming and telling us so many interesting things about this exhibition, which everyone is now going to come and see. Are you playing music in the exhibition?
Absolutely.
Of course you are. Good. I'm very pleased to hear it. And does the music come with projected colours? We've got the paintings. We don't need projected colours, do we?
There'll be so many surprises in that exhibition. Okay. There'll be colours, there'll be lights, there will be scientific instruments, there'll be sound, there'll be performance.
Free dancing.
Absolutely, you're free to perform free dance.
I can free dance. This has all been marvellous. Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.